Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Okay, let's unpack this. Jesse Livermore, he was once called the single most formidable factor in the market.
That's quite a statement, isn't it?
It really is. And what's fascinating is how private he was about his methods.
Exactly. Getting any real insight was like impossible for a long time.
Which is why this material is so valuable. We're looking at these exclusive interviews.
Conducted by Richard D. Wyckoff, who was a big name himself back then.
Right, a very respected figure in Wall Street journalism. And he did these interviews when Livermore was, you know, at the absolute peak of his powers.
And these originally appeared in the Magazine of Wall Street as a series.
That's right. So it's contemporary insight, not looking back decades later.
It's interesting who was doing the interviewing too, Wyckoff. His goal wasn't just gossip, was it?
Not at all. Wyckoff was really focused on education. The preface of this collection even says his aim was to shed light on Wall Street's ways, help the public invest more, well, intelligently.
Demystify it a bit. Exactly. And using Livermore's success during that successful period as a way to teach, it adds a layer of credibility, I think.
Yeah, for sure. And for people maybe newer to Livermore, I mean, this guy started trading at 14.
Incredible, isn't it? Made fortunes, lost them, made them back again.
He really earned that title, the market's greatest trader.
He certainly experienced the highs and lows.
So for you listening right now, maybe you want to get this knowledge quickly, thoroughly, without getting totally overwhelmed. That's kind of our mission here.
Right. We want to pull out the core ideas from Livermore himself through these rare chats. Think of it as a shortcut to understanding a legend.
Filtered through Wyckoff's experienced eye, which is key, you're getting pretty close to the source.
As close as you can get, really. Which is why it's worth paying attention to, especially if you want timeless market principles.
So let's talk about Wyckoff a bit more. Why him? How did he get Livermore to open up when others couldn't?
Well, like you said, Wyckoff had serious credibility. He wasn't just some random reporter. The book notes Livermore had been really good at, quote, evading publicity.
So he must have trusted Wyckoff.
Seems like it. Maybe Livermore saw it as a way to share his ideas without, you know, managing his own PR campaign. He knew Wyckoff would frame it educationally.
And Wyckoff's motive was public good, essentially. Help people understand the market better.
Precisely. He saw people rushing in, getting burned, and wanted to offer something more substantial. Intelligent operating methods, I think he called it.
He saw Livermore as a case study in doing it right. Based on method, not just luck.
Exactly. And by focusing on things like understanding industries, company finances, Wyckoff was hitting at what he saw as a big problem. People buying on hope, not research.
Which leads us right into Livermore's core beliefs. What did he see as the absolute essentials for success?
Two words, really. Knowledge and patience. That was his mantra.
Simple, but hard to do.
Very. He was adamant about investigating before you invest. You needed a real grasp of, well, everything economics, the company's books, what's happening in the industry, the whole economic picture.
No shortcuts.
None. He was pretty blunt about the public's tendency to chase quick witches, buying based on, you know, wishful thinking.
Yeah, he specifically warned against just buying cheap stocks because they're cheap.
Yeah, he did. He pointed out that a low price doesn't mean value. Often those stocks are cheap for a very good reason. They might be heading for trouble.
So it wasn't about bottom fishing necessarily.
No, it was about finding strength. Look for strong industries. Find the leaders in those industries. Don't mess with weak sectors or companies with shaky financials.
You mentioned ample working capital being important.
Crucial. Companies need that cushion to survive downturns, competition. He even talked about market seasons and fashions, how different sectors have their moments.
So the actionable point for listeners there is pretty clear. Do the work, Understand what you're buying.
Absolutely. Don't chase tips or low price tags blindly. Build that foundation of knowledge first.
And this wasn't just theory for him, was it? It was built into his day.
Oh, completely. His daily routine was incredibly disciplined. He made a point of going to bed early, like 10 p.m.
Wow. Why so early?
To be thoroughly refreshed, as he put it, for his morning study session, before the market even thought about opening.
So what did this pre-market routine actually involve?
It was serious study time. Like an hour or two before breakfast, he'd be analyzing global conditions, banking, foreign trade, money supply, crops, company reports, trade stats, all of it.
And he did it first thing in the morning?
Yeah, because his mind was clear. Free from the previous day's noise and biases, ready to absorb and analyze fresh information objectively.
That makes sense. A clean slate. And he wasn't just skimming headlines, I gather.
No. He read the major papers meticulously, looking beyond the headlines, searching for the vital facts that might be hidden away somewhere less obvious.
Didn't he travel thousands of miles once based on some small news item?
That's the famous story. A tiny dividend notice or something similar. It just shows his dedication to finding those hidden clues, those little details that could mean a lot.
That level of commitment is, well, it's intense. Really shows how crucial he thought preparation was.
Non-negotiable for him. And this focus, this need for concentration, it carried over into his trading environment, too.
Right. He didn't like trading floors or brokerage offices, did he?
Hated them. He called it the demoralizing hubbub. All the tips, the gossip, the noise. He felt it warped your judgment.
So he preferred his own space.
Absolutely. Private offices. Quiet. Where he could concentrate and make unbiased decisions. He even avoided market talk on his commute.
Really? Just shut it out?
Yeah, to keep his mind clear, protect his mental state before the trading day began.
That's a powerful lesson for today, isn't it? With constant news feeds and social media chatter, find your own quiet space for analysis.
Definitely. Filter out the noise. Think independently.
So he did all this fundamental work, built this deep understanding, but his actual trading decisions came down to something else.
Yes. While the fundamentals provided the, let's say, the backdrop, the context, his timing, his actual buy and sell triggers, came from reading the tape.
Reading the tape, the classic Livermore technique. Can you break that down for us? What exactly was he watching for on that ticker tip?
He was looking for patterns, for confirmation, things like strength or weakness right at the opening bell, which stocks were leading, which groups were moving together, signs of manipulation, weird volume, unnatural price moves, overall volume trends. How stocks reacted to news? Did they shrug it off or move strongly?
The character of the buying and selling too.
Yes, exactly. Was it urgent, aggressive buying, or hesitant? Big blocks trading or lots of small retail orders. The speed of moves up or down. How the market behaved at key resistance or support levels.
Trying to spot accumulation or distribution.
Precisely. Were the big players quietly buying in accumulation or maybe quietly selling out distribution? He looked for clues like heavy volume when a stock broke through resistance that suggested real buying power. Low volume moves. He often dismissed those as just noise.
It sounds like he was trying to decode the market's real intentions beneath all the news and hype.
That's a great way to put it. He believed the tape showed the real purpose behind it all. It was about anticipating the next likely move based on current action.
Anticipation, that was key.
Absolutely central. Using the tape's signals to get ahead of the curve, not just react after the fact.
Now, of course, even with all that analysis, you're going to be wrong sometimes. Losses happen. How did Livermore deal with risk?
His rule was ironclad. Cut your losses short, quickly. Decisively.
He was famous for that, right? Unlike the average person who tends to hold on and hope.
Exactly the opposite. He also aimed for a pretty significant potential profit on every trade he mentioned, at least 10 points.
10 points. Why so specific?
It built a cushion. If your winners are big enough, they can pay for the inevitable small losses. It's about the risk-reward ratio. He needed the potential upside to justify the risk.
And how did he implement the cut losses short rule?
He'd figure out his danger point beforehand. The price level, where his idea was clearly wrong. He'd try to make his first entry close to that point. If the stock moved against him or just didn't act right,
he was out.
Immediately. No hesitation, no second guessing, just execute the exit.
And he didn't just cut losses, he also cut trades that weren't working out, even if they weren't losing yet.
Right. He believed in keeping his capital active, turning it over. If a stock didn't start moving his way within a few days, even if it was just sitting there flat, he'd often sell it.
Why?
Opportunity cost. He compared it to a department store manager getting rid of slow-moving merchandise. Why tie up capital and shelf space on something that isn't performing when you could put it into something with more potential?
That makes a lot of sense. Money stuck in a dead trade isn't working for you.
Precisely. Holding on to those stagnant positions means you might miss the next big move.
So what kind of stocks did he actually prefer to trade? Was he a blue chip guy?
Generally, no. He liked action. He preferred the fast movers, as he called them. Stocks with volatility, wide price swings. Often the market leaders in the strong sectors he'd identified.
So not the slow, steady dividend payers, typically?
Not usually, unless maybe they were showing signs of breaking out of a long base or something unusual was happening. He wanted stocks that could give him those 10 points or more reasonably quickly.
Did price matter? Low-priced versus high-priced?
He wasn't against lower-priced stocks if the percentage return potential looked really good, but his main focus seemed to be on stocks capable of significant point moves, and these often had strong volume associated with their moves. He'd maybe look at a blue chip if it showed exceptional signs, like breaking a long consolidation on huge volume, signaling a new trend.
Okay. And when he did find a winner, how did he add to that position? Did he go all in?
He used a technique called pyramiding, but carefully. It wasn't about just blindly buying more.
How did it work?
He'd start with a partial position, maybe a quarter or a half of what he ultimately intended to trade. Then, if the stock moved in his favor, confirming his judgment,
he could add more.
Exactly. He'd add on the way up, using the market's confirmation to increase his stake. Crucially, this is the opposite of averaging down.
Right, buying more of a loser, which he strongly advised against.
Absolutely. He only added to trades that were already profitable. Each new buy point was based on the stock proving him right again. It fit with his whole philosophy of staying clear-headed for those really big market moments, the panic bottoms and the boom tops.
So let's try to pull this all together. For someone listening today, maybe not a full-time trader, what are the really practical things they can take away from Livermore?
Well, several big ones stand out. First, that need for dedicated study. Maybe not hours every morning, but carving out consistent time for your own research is vital.
Even just sticking to a routine.
Yes. Second, cultivate that independent thinking. Learn to filter the noise, the tips, the hype. Form your own conclusions based on your research.
Don't just follow the crowd.
Definitely not. Third, and this applies to literally everyone who invests, risk management. Know why you bought something. Know at what point your thesis is wrong, and have the discipline to cut losses when it is.
That's probably the hardest one for most people.
It often is. And finally, even just appreciating his focus on observing the market's action price, volume, behavior can give you a different, maybe more objective perspective, whatever your style.
Okay, so to summarize this deep dive into Jesse Livermore for everyone, We've seen this really interesting mix of deep fundamental homework combined with sharp observation of the tape.
Right. Understanding the what and the why behind a stock, but timing based on the how it's trading.
Plus this incredible personal discipline, the routine, the focus, the isolation from noise.
Which allowed for that independent judgment he valued so highly.
And then the strict risk management, especially cutting those losses without hesitation.
That was non-negotiable for him. Let your winners run, cut your losers short.
So maybe a final thought to leave our listeners with.
Well, thinking about Livermore, in a world just flooded with opinions, forecasts, analysis everywhere you look, he really prioritized listening to the market itself.
Through the tape.
Through the tape, through its actual behavior. So the question maybe is, how much attention are you really paying to the market's own voice compared to just listening to everyone talking about the market?
That's a great question to ponder, a really powerful point. We hope this deep dive gave you some valuable things to think about, some actionable insights from a true market giant.
Yeah, definitely some timeless principles in there.
And as always, check out our show notes. We'll have a summary of Livermore's key ideas, maybe some links related to Wyckoff's work, and suggestions if you want to read more on trading psychology or analysis.
We might even put in a discussion question about disciplined investing, see what experiences people have had.
Sounds good. Until our next deep dive, keep exploring, stay curious, and thanks for listening.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed sponsored jobs. With Indeed-sponsored jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed-sponsored jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.